This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to start our show with a new book about a topic we've talked about before, but this is a book that is titled American Hemp, How Growing Our Newest Cash Crop Can Improve Our Health, Clean Our Environment, and Slow Climate Change. And we have on the phone Jen Hobbs. She's the author, and she joins us from St. Charles County in Missouri to talk about her book. Thanks for being with us, Jen.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you write the book?
Well, I've always been interested in our history with cannabis in general. And I don't know if you're aware, but I was the co-author for Jesse Ventura's Marijuana Manifesto. And that came out in 2016. And while the book focused primarily on his views on marijuana, we did include a chapter in there on hemp. And it was an overview of the plant and how it's different from marijuana and all sorts of properties and benefits. And I really felt that hemp needed its own book to really go into those attributes in more detail. So that's really what inspired this book.
Well, as you mentioned it, I did come across that, Jesse Ventura's Marijuana Manifesto, which you co-authored with him 3 years ago. And he writes the foreword to this book as well, in which he reminds us of the history of hemp and other forms of cannabis. So boil that down for our listeners now, because some of this is probably a little surprising.
Sure. So the major difference between hemp and marijuana is the THC content in the plant. It's 0.3% around that range for hemp. And obviously marijuana, it's a lot more than that. The two plants are used for entirely different purposes. Marijuana is used for that euphoric high feeling, and hemp is used for all sorts of industrial purposes. Obviously, we know rope, paper, clothing, but it can also be used for making plastic, building materials, and all sorts of new technology. And I also mentioned in the book how they are grown differently. Their appearance is very different. Hemp has a long stalk that's similar to bamboo, while marijuana grows more like a shrub or a bush and has larger leaves. So the two plants are pretty significant as far as their differences. However, when our country was coming up with legislation for marijuana in the 1930s, the two plants were lumped together under the Marijuana Tax Act, and that's where a lot of the confusion comes between the two plants and really just culturally speaking why there's so much confusion.
The part of the foreword that really caught my attention was when Jesse Ventura reminded us that certain states, like California, have made recreational marijuana legal, but it's still illegal to grow hemp, or was until the 2018 Farm Bill.
Right. It's very interesting to me, especially because, you know, hemp and marijuana were both on these Schedule I narcotics list. You know, they were both considered the same thing by the DEA until the 2018 Farm Bill made that distinction. So if you think about it, you know, if you're going to legalize something, you could legalize both at the same time. And Colorado is an example of that. They legalized hemp and marijuana simultaneously, but most states haven't done that. They've gone the route of legalizing medical marijuana and then recreational marijuana, and hemp is an afterthought, especially in California.
Well, let's dig into a little bit of the history here, because hemp, as you mentioned, was made illegal in the 30s with the Marijuana Tax Act, and now it has been reclassified as an agricultural crop in the 2018 Farm Bill. Why was it ever considered illegal? You know, you've talked about the properties of THC in marijuana, but what was going on? Why was it made illegal in the first place?
Well, for a couple of reasons. Number one, during the 1930s, the Secretary of the U.S. Department of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, was trying to come up with new ways to raise money for the federal government in form of taxes. And the marijuana in general and hemp also, depending on, you know, if you're a at the time, if you were a business that saw hemp as a competition, the federal government realized they couldn't ban marijuana or ban hemp, but they could tax it to the point where people weren't inclined to produce it, or in the case of marijuana, that doctors didn't want to take the risk of prescribing it. So that's really what led to it becoming illegal in the country. And one of the business owners, William Randolph Hearst, he had one of the largest newspaper chains in the country, and founded the media company Hearst Communications, which obviously is still around today. He saw hemp as direct competition for his empire, because he had forests and he was able to produce all the paper that he needed. And, you know, there were articles at the time that were written about, you know, how hemp could become the newest cash crop because new farming equipment had been invented in Europe. And it really seemed like another source of income for farmers. And he didn't want to see that happen, because he didn't want to be competing against people who would make paper out of hemp. Another instance is also DuPont, which is obviously still around today, the petrochemical company. They were also into making paper, and they had, at the time, lucrative chemical patents. And what's really interesting is that Andrew Mellon, who is the secretary of the Department of the Treasury, he also was financing DuPont simultaneously. So he didn't want anything to jeopardize that company, and he felt inclined to, you know, really try and come up with some legislation to, you know, just to get rid of hemp as a competition.
Well, these are very powerful people, and these businesses, as you mentioned, still exist today. What do you think prompted the decision to get this into the 2018 Farm Bill and make hemp an agricultural crop that's legal?
So it seems really interesting, the about face that you know, the federal government has now made. It's been many years in the making. Obviously, the 2014 Farm Bill started the industrial hemp pilot program, where states could start growing the crop.
And North Dakota had one of those.
Yes, yes. You've had one for about 4 years now, yeah? You started around the 2014 Farm Bill, mm-hmm. I believe. These hemp farmers, you know, as time went on, were wondering, well, are we going to legalize this or not? Can't we just make this into a commercial product like Canada does, and, you know, really take advantage of all the monetary benefits? So every year since the 2014 Farm Bill, there's been legislation in Congress to do that, to take hemp off of the Schedule I narcotics list so that people growing it can have access to bank accounts, credit cards, crop insurance. And it can really become a major industry again. However, that legislation just never went anywhere. It would get referred to a committee or to the DEA or to the FDA, and it just never went anywhere. And then once it was time to revise the Farm Bill in 2018, Mitch McConnell put the Industrial Hemp Farming Act into the Farm Bill, and that's how we now have the legalization today.
So it's federally legal. Can anybody grow it?
Unfortunately, no. it's a strange situation. Right now, the way that the law is set up, you have to go through your state agricultural department, just like in the industrial hemp pilot program, and apply for permitting and licensing and get approval to grow it. And depending on which state you live in, that process can be inexpensive, or it could be based per acre. The price range varies. And then obviously in states like South Dakota and Idaho, they decided, you know, they're not going to do that, and they're going to keep hemp illegal until the federal agricultural department comes out with their own regulations.
Huh. So, catch 22.
Yes, it's very weird. And then also for, you know, the average person, what that means for us is, you know, we can go down to the store and pick up a pack of tomato seeds or squash or zucchini or corn and grow that in our backyards, but we are not able to do that with hemp.
Now,
even though it's an agricultural crop.
Your book is a collection of information. How did you go about gathering it, and how did you, you know, vet it, evaluate the information you came across?
Well, a lot of the information I actually became aware of while we were writing Jesse Ventura's Marijuana Manifesto. And I really had a hard time condensing the information. So that's really where, I guess, the main points come from. And then what I primarily did was I took a look at independent studies and research from all over the world in many different aspects of hemp, and you know, looked at what that research stated, and then also any commercial applications of it. So the book goes through a whole range of things that you can do with it, and then it also presents scenarios where it's been implemented or it could be implemented, and you can see the value of it from, you know, not just another tool for our economy, but for the environment as well. Because what I found was the majority of these products that can be made out of hemp, or when you take hemp and place it into a product, you know, like, use it for car door panels or something of that nature, it actually really helps with our environmental footprint, because hemp doesn't rely on those same synthetic chemicals, and it's not as environmentally taxing to produce these products.
Well, as you mentioned, it's not necessarily easy to grow hemp legally, at any rate.
Right.
Is the market in place to use hemp that is grown, or does it need to be built?
Well, for a consumer, honestly, I see more products in the store every day. It's really interesting. Obviously, we've always had hemp nutrition foods, as far as hemp hearts, hemp seed, hemp protein shakes and powders. You know, but there's also hemp lotions and CBD products now, and you know, obviously clothing. So there's a whole range of things that you can buy as a consumer currently. And then, of course, there's new avenues as well. You know, there's a lot of things that I have, the topics that I discuss in the book, for example, making plastic out of hemp. And there's a company that now that's looking to take, you know, any leftovers from hemp processing for, you know, nutritional benefits, because obviously, you only use the hemp seed, and then you don't need the rest of the plant. So what he does is he takes the rest of the plant, the biomass of the plant, and then makes plastic bottles out of it. And that plastic is then more biodegradable. And so there's, you know, it just depends on the supply chain is really what we have to look at. You know, there's all these ways to use it, and it just depends on, you know, what's going to be set up, who's going to be setting up a business, and how that is all going to work out. So it's a really exciting time.
Well, it is an exciting time. It's a new possible cash crop for some people, but I think out there also is whether or not it's being hyped. Is it something beyond what it really is, you know? For example, the medicinal qualities of medical marijuana. What do we really know about some of this stuff?
Well, I do have a CBD chapter in the book, and in Jesse Ventura's Marijuana Manifesto, we do cover the medicinal benefits of marijuana. And there are a lot of studies that show it has a positive, especially CBD, has a positive impact on a lot of different, just all different types of ailments, from, you know, pain, severe pain, to epilepsy, to seizures, to even anxiety. And also the FDA did just approve the first pharmaceutical drug called Epidolex, and that has a combination of THC and CBD in it. So this is the first drug with CBD that can be prescribed by a doctor, and you know, it's specifically for seizures, for rare seizure disorders that are not really treatable with anything else. So that's pretty fascinating to me, to see that, you know, the potential for this really in my mind is, you know, it's not necessarily going to displace things. It's going to add to it and, you know, really pick up the missing pieces. So these people that have, you know, Dravet syndrome that are going to, you know, it's a rare condition and they have multiple seizures a day. And this is going to stop that from occurring and really help them, you know, regain their lives and have more meaningful experiences.
Well, I also noted that you and your husband are getting into the business, so you're putting some money where your book is.
Yes, we do have a we have grown medical marijuana in the past. My husband is actually a medical marijuana patient. And we moved to California so he could gain access to it. And we grew medical marijuana while we were there. And now that we are in Missouri, where my husband's actually looking to set up a CBD shop locally here, which should be open in next month in May. So that's, you know, it's pretty exciting as well. And he also has a product online that people can purchase that it's called Spaced Cowboy.
Uh-huh.
It's a pre-rolled joint that has a waxed tip to it. It's pretty interesting, and that's been getting pretty popular, especially now that CBD flower is legal.
So you're in the business of extracting the cannabinoid and selling rolling papers. You're in it from hemp to recreational to medicinal.
I mean, it's like I said, it's for me, I've always been interested in the history of it. I've been an advocate for it, and I've seen how well it works. I mean, the impact of it in my own life. And that's also something that, you know, Jesse Ventura and I have in common. He's seen just remarkable things, you know, with his family members that have taken it for medicinal purposes, how it's helped them. So, you know, when you see how much this plant can do, you know, it's really hard not to try and get involved and do everything you can to help it succeed.
The book is American Hemp, How Growing Our Newest Cash Crop Can Improve Our Health, Clean Our Environment, and Slow Climate Change. We've been talking with Jen Hobbs, the author. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
More Main Street in a moment.
The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus will present North Dakota Sings Saturday, April 27th at 7:30 p.m. at the Belmehus Auditorium. The concert will feature a wide variety of musical arrangements of popular sing-along songs such as Danny Boy, This Little Light of Mine, and I Sing Because I'm Happy, as well as choral classics Earth Song and North Dakota Prairies. Tickets are available at Eckroth Music, at bismanchorus.com, and at the door. The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus, your community, your chorus. For more information, please call 701-400-7774 or online bismanchorus.com.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2019 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2019 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As humans, we tend to crave novelty, and occasionally we might complain about being bored, having nothing to do. Alex Cusa says if you struggle with boredom, you might want to adjust that attitude. Here's Cusa's essay, Seven Ways to Engage with Your Community.
When I graduated from Concordia College, I wanted to relocate to a big city because there are more things to do. But instead, in July 2015, I joined Folkways, a social venture that nurtures cultural creators to create community. Community engagement instills a sense of belonging. After joining different circles and networks in the area, I went from there's not much to do to an overwhelmingly I cannot do it all. Here are seven of my favorite ways to engage the community. Number one, talking to the ambassadors. At Folkways, we believe that the ambassadors of our community are the individuals that have hundreds of interactions with people on a daily basis. Baristas, artists, entrepreneurs, owners of local businesses. They are approachable, they know the pulse of the area. Many times I've interacted with these valuable ambassadors when promoting an event or even hanging posters on their rich community walls or windows. Number two, community events. Knowing exactly when and where events are happening is a team effort. Inviting people to events I was aware of resulted in the same people always remembering to invite me to other community events they are aware of. Number three, college community. Colleges are vibrant, rejuvenating, and they dictate the pulse of the area. The different sports events, arts events, multicultural festivals, and keynote speakers should not be overlooked. Number four, piercing one bubble. I compare it to people preparing for a marathon and the different milestones they have to check off before getting to the actual race. It is the same for joining new circles or networks. You do it with an incremental approach, otherwise you would be overwhelmed and discouraged. The sense of discomfort is a sign of personal growth. Think of it like working out. Soreness can mean progress. Number five, volunteer. This can be a weekly, monthly, or even yearly habit where you decide to reach out to local nonprofit. I can assure you that help is always welcomed. I'm always grateful to be part of a community that empowers, celebrates, and supports nonprofits with yearly events like Giving Hearts Day and online efforts to raise money for nonprofits across the Midwest region. Number six, do it yourself or DIY. Sometimes there's a club or a circle you want to join but it doesn't exist. This is when you create this non-existing group. Social media can connect you to other people in the community sharing your passion for this new thing. This is one of my favorite ways of meeting new people. There's an automatic sense of ownership and pride by the members of this newly created group. Last but not least, number seven, the power of showing up. None of this would be possible if you don't do what Woody Allen says of success. 80% is showing up. The 20% left usually is being approachable by smiling, how you present yourself at community events, plus the time and effort you're willing to give to the community. And once you have shown up, you might as well give it a shot and engage with at least one of the organizers at the event in order to add an ambassador to your list of friends. This is Alexandre Cusa.
Cusa is a community liaison for Folkways, which promotes community culture. He's one of the writers of the Think Global, Act Local column published in Fargo Monthly magazine. Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about the latest developments with drones. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. An amendment to the budget bill for the North Dakota Insurance Department caused some controversy during House debate today. The amendment said an insurance policy may not take into account any pre-existing conditions. Bismarck Republican Representative Rick Becker objected.
In essence, what we're saying is, if the ACA, PPAC, Obamacare dissolves or morphs into something entirely different, we like it so much here in North Dakota that we're going to put significant components of the ACA into our own statute so that even if that goes away federally, we're going to keep it here statewide. And I think that is a pretty rotten part of this bill, and I will be voting red because of that.
But the bill passed on a vote of 55 to 33. It will go back to the Senate for further work. Meanwhile, State Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried says the language of the amendment doesn't accomplish the intent, which was to continue the pre-existing condition part of the Affordable Care Act if the act goes away. Gottfried says he doesn't see the ACA will go away anytime soon.
So I think we've got some time here. I wouldn't mind taking a look at studying and how do we do that, because we looked at it initially at the beginning of the session, if this is possible and how do we do it, and it got a little cumbersome trying to interact with the federal law and state law and how do we make this work. And so a spring provision, say where the ACA goes away and has this spring into effect, may be a good option, but I think we've got some time to figure that out.
Gottfried says there are lawsuits to get rid of the act, but he says that will take time as the case winds its way through the court system.
We are still an island. There's still no roads are open, and I don't expect anything to be open anytime soon.
That's Oslo, Minnesota Mayor Erica Martens describing the flood picture for her community. Highways in and out of Oslo have been topped by floodwaters from the Red River. The Red River is holding steady at about 37 feet and is forecast to stay at that level at least through the coming weekend. Martens credits the level of preparedness the community undertook going into the spring thaw. She says at this point, things are moving smoothly and people are trying to make the best out of the situation.
We have a little school going on for the children that weren't able to get out. Dulcer Motors donated their space over in their showroom. That's our school room right now. The churches are still holding services. It's really, really hate to say it, it's business as usual, just at a smaller scale.
About 30 members of the Minnesota National Guard have been dispatched to help during the flooding. Martin says while the residents of Oslo wait out the river crest, they also keep a nervous eye on the weather. She says a re-rise on the Red is possible with any new precipitation along the river's path. And the tax filing season is rapidly coming to a close. Around 478,000 North Dakota individual income tax returns are expected to be filed this season. As of late last week, the state tax department has already heard from 345,000 North Dakotans. Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger says refunds are averaging around $200, down slightly from 1 year ago. Rauschenberger says collections have been strong as well.
We have low unemployment. We have a lot of returns coming in with higher wages, good wage growth in North Dakota. So we've actually been exceeding forecast so far this January, February, and March. And depending on how April shakes out, we do expect to be even ahead of overall collections in the filing season, from far ahead from where we were even just last year.
Rauschenberger says 92% of returns have been e-filed. He says that percentage will likely come down as more complicated returns tend to come in right at the end. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
It's never too early to start estate planning. Join Prairie Public for a free lunch and learn, Financial and Estate Planning Basics, Tuesday, April 30th at 11:30 at Prairie Public's television studio in downtown Fargo. Explore important issues such as tax reform, charitable IRA giving, choosing an executor or a trustee, working with an attorney, and paying attention to who's in your will. Register online at prairiepublic.org/lunch or call me, Cassie Shipley, at 701-239-7538.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Terry Zimmerman. She is the CEO of Botlink. Terry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Joey Schmidt, he is the CEO of Flight Pros ND. Joey, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about drones, unmanned air vehicles, UAVs, I guess, and they're something that's become very important to North Dakota, but let's get a little background first. Terry, tell us about Botlink. What is your business? What do you do, especially with unmanned vehicles like this?
Botlink provides an operations platform for operators for unmanned aircraft. So we provide and develop software to enable the safe integration of unmanned aircraft into the national airspace. So command and control of your drone enables you to take the data that you're collecting from your drone and save that into a secure web-based backend so you can access that information and take measurements if you're in the industry, such as aggregate with stockpiles. You can take volumetrics and take the volume measure.
Just fly over it and just determine how much is there, huh?
Exactly.
And so what you're doing basically is air traffic control for drones.
Essentially, yes. I mean, you can log your mission. So if you know you want to fly over a sand pile, for example, if you're an aggregate company, then you can select that mission with the software and then fly that automatically.
Okay. So, Joey, what is Flight Pros ND?
Flight Pros is a drone services provider. So we fly drones for other companies that need to gather aerial data. So we fly dozens of different platforms, fixed wing, multi-rotor drones with a bunch of different sensors, whether it's color, NDVI for looking at crop health, or thermal imagery for searching for a missing person. So that's what we do, is just making sure that the process is really easy for the customer and they don't have any liability.
So you've got the hardware, you've got the software, I take it.
That's right.
That's right.
All right. So let's talk a bit about why you're working together. There's something about operations over people. It's got this neat OOP, abbreviation. Terry, what is that?
Well, as you probably noticed, we're starting to see more drones every day, and we are seeing drones integrated more into the national airspace. Up until recently, there was really only a handful of companies in the United States that have obtained a waiver to fly a drone operations over people. And President Trump and Secretary Chao from the Department of Transportation felt the United States was starting to lag behind other countries and wanted to accelerate unmanned aircraft in the United States. So they've been working and collaborating with a small group of people. About 10 groups in the United States were selected. The North Dakota Department of Transportation was selected as one of those, along with the Northern Plains Test Site. And they have asked BotLink to assist in some of the operations over people and beyond visual line of sight work. So essentially what the FAA is working on is identifying what are the risks associated with flying over people, and then how do we safely mitigate those risks. So we've been assisting the North Dakota Department of Transportation in some of the flights.
And Joey, describe the kind of the variation of things you can do with drones. Terry has, sort of suggested some of this, flying over aggregates and maybe checking power lines, things like that. What's the range of opportunities here?
Well, I think it started, drones really hit the market doing advertising, marketing services, getting really beautiful video and photos for people. And then it started to expand into the inspection services. So that's just with the color imagery. But then looking at zoom capabilities, so taking a 30-time zoom camera and checking the cracks or structures on a wind turbine, for example.
Wow.
And then also you can put any sense. It's basically a platform to get a sensor in the sky. So when you think about it, it's really just a tool. So how can you get a sensor in the sky to detect methane gas leak or to determine the elevations with LIDAR underneath the water? So you can do so many different things with these systems that we're just scratching the surface. So it's a really interesting industry.
And North Dakota is on the forefront of this, Terry.
Yes, that's correct. We have a test site located here in North Dakota, the Northern Plains Test Site located in Grand Forks. And we also were selected, the North Dakota Department of Transportation was selected to be part of the integration pilot program. And we have a number of companies here in Fargo and in Grand Forks that have been working in the unmanned aircraft field, including large companies like Northrop Grumman and General Atomics.
And we've been talking about what BotLink does, which is provide some sort of air traffic control structure for drone flights. And if these things become as ubiquitous as everybody says they're going to be, why not? If we're talking about delivering pizzas or beer with them, that was years ago. But now we're talking about doing all kinds of things that really required men doing very dangerous things to check out a wind turbine crack or something like that, for example. The sky seems to be the limit here.
I think, there's drones have, the FAA did not expect so many drone pilots to become certified immediately. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of thousands in the U.S. that have already been certified through the 107 program, and that's in 2 years.
What's the 107 program?
The 107 program is if you are wanting to be a commercial pilot with drones, UAVs, UAS, you need to go through a certain certification through the FAA. It's a 60-question test, $150, and you can become certified to fly drones commercially through the Part 107 certification.
Now, as I understand it, in these early days of drone flight, you had to have line of sight with the drone. And there was a certain altitude it couldn't come under, and there were other all kinds of restrictions about, you know, not looking improperly at places you're not supposed to be looking at. So at this point in the business that you run, what is holding you back?
Well, in the current 107 commercial operator rules, you have to fly underneath 400 feet. You have to fly not over people, not over moving vehicles, and always within visual line of sight, among many other things. And when you think about what you were talking about earlier about delivering something, or in my line of work, if we're going to go inspect a stream beyond a line of trees, we aren't going to be able to see our UAV at all times. So to unlock that beyond visual line of sight and to unlock us to fly over people, like on a construction site where we have people in hard hats, but we know we need to operate over them to gather the information. Those are really a key to making business flourish.
So the challenge here is coming up with a system, and I suppose, Terry, that's part of what BotLink's involved in, that makes it work, that doesn't require you to have line of sight all the time.
That's correct. Today we are just scratching the surface of the potential applications of using drones. We primarily think about capturing imagery with a drone. We are currently working with the U.S. Army in Africa to do air quality sensing as well. And as we see the FAA create more safety regulations, we'll see more and more applications with unmanned aircraft. But as we look at the sky today, manned aircraft, there's probably 10,000 planes above the United States at any given time. Mm-hmm. Envision that many drones above a given city in the future as we unlock some of those potentials. So I think the key to the future is really creating autonomous systems and air traffic management so that drones can be safely navigated in our skies.
And when you talk about autonomous systems, that doesn't just include things that are in the sky. We're talking about autonomous vehicles on the ground as well.
Correct. I mean, there has been tremendous advances in autonomous systems on the ground. We're seeing many advances in autonomous vehicles, more miles and data being collected every day across the United States and across the world. And that data can be utilized to help us create safer autonomous systems.
Joey, one of the things we've been seeing recently because of Mother Nature has been these views of the flood. Flooding Red River in our particular case. And that has been kind of eye-opening. I mean, we've always been able to fly over floods, but it's been, you know, a plane with a camera and not the kind of, 24/7 thing you can do with a drone.
Yeah, to have that vantage point of anywhere, anytime with a drone is pretty, it's pretty unreal. And utilizing that right here in Fargo and especially in Grand Forks are utilizing it heavily. Mm-hmm. Looking at this flood, there's a coordinated effort right now in the whole city of Grand Forks to fly every exit that's affected for the North Dakota Department of Transportation.
So how did you get this assignment?
Through BotLink.
Yeah. There you go. There it is.
They're helping and assisting the Department of Transportation with the operations over people. And they needed additional pilots to go out and document the flood. Mm-hmm. And at Flight Pros, I've had over 400 hours of stick time on a drone, and that might not seem like a lot to some manned pilots, but it's a lot when you're flying 20 minutes at a time with a drone.
Well, and let's talk about the range of drones that you have. You talked about these, you know, the ones that look like four propeller helicopters that are pretty common. Those are kind of the hobby ones that you see in stores a lot. But there are big drones, too, drones that can carry payloads.
Yes, we have a wide range. We have some of those hobby-grade drones just because you want to get data for the cheapest possible thing you can put in the air, in our perspective, from a business. But we also have drones that can carry up to 15 pounds. So you can really strap on some large sensors to those and make sure you get exactly the data that you want.
Terry, describe what is mission control for BotLink. Is there a hub that BotLink operates for where all this information is coming in?
Well, mission control. So if you, for example, we have this waiver for sustained operations over people to fly the flood. So our mission was really to fly and check the flood walls and the bridges. And so we logged our mission into the software, determined the area we were going to fly, and then the drone flew that mission. So we have built the software to allow you to autonomously fly a drone using our command and control.
So you basically just load this information into the drone, tell it where to go, what altitude, what to look for, and then come back, and there's a record of it.
Right. So you can use your handheld device, your phone, your tablet, and enter the location you want to fly. And then the drone is location aware, so when you get to that location, then you can hit the button to fly the drone, and it will fly that mission for
now,
you.
How important is it that you're doing this operations over people piece here?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is one of those barriers that we were talking about in terms of drone operation.
Right. When you think about technology, there's been technology out there where people have been flying over people. Primarily helicopters would be used in situations where there was a flood or a manned aircraft. But there's a lot of noise that comes with that, and it's very costly. With a drone, you can capture that information, much more area information at a lower cost, but you weren't able to fly over people. At BotLink, we got the first waiver for sustained operations over people so that you can fly over an area, but we really stick to the mission. Like, what is the mission? It's to capture what's going on with those flood walls, what's going on with the bridge. The objective isn't necessarily just to fly over people, but there could be people around. So you have to follow all those safety regulations, identifying all the risk, making sure that your airframe has the right protections around the propellers. We fly our drone with a parachute on board to reduce any of the weight of a drone that might fall out of the sky, so there'd be a limited impact from the drone falling down. So we really look at all of the risks associated with the drone and then mitigate those with our software and our technology in addition to parachute and protected propellers. And also, you know, where Joey comes in is that we always fly with a certified Part 107 FAA pilots, make sure we have very qualified pilots that are flying our drones.
So, Joey, this is a question I ask every time I have somebody in who's knowledge about drones, and that is, you know, 10 years from now, how do you envision our lives being changed or are the sky looking different or whatever?
I do see much more autonomy, whether it be small-scale delivery in town for immediate delivery. I do see the convergence of hardware, software, artificial intelligence really pushing the boundaries of what can be inspected to make sure that we're efficient with energy. I see that as being a big push in the drone sector. And I see the drone world from an operator standpoint. I see it becoming safer and more easily to manage because the FAA and all the people have experienced what has come in the last 5 years and in 10 years, 15 years. So we're going to have a better idea of what to expect and how to handle mistakes or how to handle rules going forward. So I'm pretty excited for it.
Well, we've been talking about, you know, monitoring flooding and maybe checking out wind towers, you know, remotely and safely and all that kind of thing. Is there an application that we're just on the verge of that you're pretty excited about?
I am. If there is a beyond visual line of sight and operations over people, if that gets ironed out, the idea of having a vehicle, an autonomous vehicle on site that can launch itself and inspect a site by itself with humans to maintenance the equipment, it would be amazing, especially for, like Terry was saying, for aggregate sites.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding your inventory on a day-to-day basis. And you just launch a drone from a bunker, you know, 400 miles away. It doesn't matter. It's just autonomously gathering the data and making business decisions for you.
So, Terry, BotLink is getting in on the ground floor of something that could be immense.
Yes, it really is an exciting industry. I view this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity where this whole new industry is born. We've been fortunate to have some great customers and partners with the North Dakota Department of Transportation and the Northern Plains Test Site. The first customer using our command and control was NASA. So we've been involved with NASA on a number of projects, including Beyond Visual Line of Sight. We have built an onboard mobile device that can track your drone anywhere in the world and enable beyond visual line of sight. So we're collaborating with NASA and the FAA on programs for beyond visual line of sight for the future.
So this is an exploding technology with lots of potential, and one would think there would be people getting into this in a competitive way. I mean, is BotLink under pressure?
You know, absolutely. This is, you know, whenever there's a fast-growing market, there's always a lot of competition showing up on the doorstep. So we do see competitors in the marketplace with command and control solutions. We uniquely have a strong group of partners that we collaborate with. We also have a patent for remediation in restricted airspace. And just last week, we received a patent for our collision avoidance technology.
Joey, this is really leaping into the future a bit here, but is it unrealistic to think that someday that drones will be moving people?
Absolutely not. I think it's very realistic. Am I going to be involved in the liability of that? No. With this technology, and it's being proven time and time again, a human being, it sounds weird, but it's just a payload.
Yeah.
And to have a tool to bring you someplace else in a tube in the sky instead of on a road on the ground. So it could be a game changer. I really do believe it's going to happen.
Wow. So I asked Joey this, Terry. Where does BotLink see this in 10 years? What do you envision above us?
I definitely see unmanned aircraft utilized for more applications. As I mentioned earlier, we really think of it as aerial imagery, the delivery of supplies, medical supplies to underdeveloped countries. We've heard of some projects going on in Africa. Providing blood and medical supplies, I think, will be something that will be more prevalent, delivery of packages. I think we'll look to the skies and see 10,000 drones above a city that are going to change the way people live their lives.
Wow. I mean, that's mind-boggling to think of, you know, looking up in Fargo, and occasionally we see a drone now, but that being more the case than not, there literally being lots of things up there all the time. That's a difference.
The key will be the enabling technology that will enable safe traffic amongst multiple drones in the air.
That's Terry Zimmerman. She's the CEO of BotLink. And Joey Schmidt was with us as well, CEO of Flight Pros North Dakota. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority, and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan, on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 15th. Today marks the anniversary of an extraordinary event in the lifetime of Hatton native Carl Ben Eielson. In 1927, an Australian adventurer, George Wilkins, had been trying for several years to realize a dream of being the first to fly over the Arctic from Alaska to Norway. After trying several pilots who crashed several planes, people were shaking their heads that he was still trying. Another explorer recommended Eielson, who had become a legendary pilot in Alaska. Eielson was at a low point, having lost a flying contract. He was back in North Dakota at a Langdon barbershop when he got the call. The journey would become one of the most epic achievements of all time. Remember, it was 1927, and they only had a small Stinson biplane. They took off from Barrow, Alaska on March 29, 1927. It was 30 degrees below zero. After several hours exploring the way north, their engine started cutting out. They made an emergency landing on an ice floe, the first landing ever made on floating ice. After 2 hours and five tries, they became airborne again, but they were soon hit by a storm and had to land. By the time they could fly again, darkness had fallen. They fought against a 40-mile-an-hour side wind, and making matters worse, their instruments weren't illuminated. Wilkins was leaning forward over the gas tank with a guarded torchlight when the engine cut out. They had run out of gas. In his book, Flying in the Arctic, Wilkins later wrote, "As we came within a few hundred feet of the ground, we could dimly see it, serrated with ice ridges." Near the ground, the air was rough. The plane swerved and pitched, but Eielson, still calm and cool, corrected for each unsteady move. They came down hard, plowing into the snow. Wilkins slipped through the door of the machine, driving snow filling his eyes. Dimly about them, he saw pressure ridges as high as the machine. The lower wing was torn, and the stanchions for the skis were twisted and broken. They had landed on a smooth stretch of ice between the towering ridges. They had been extraordinarily lucky, but their island was drifting, and there was no hope of finding their way to safety until the storm subsided. We'll bring you the conclusion of this story tomorrow. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Scientists around the world are starting to use a new technique to edit genes, and they're trying to cure diseases.
2019 is the year when the training wheels come off, and the world gets to see what CRISPR can really do for the world.
A look at the first attempts to use gene editing to help sick people. That's on the next morning edition.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, the North Country Trail Dakota Prairie Chapter is getting ready for its annual hiking expo. And we'll hear about the expo and the North Country Trail from Jan Olford Stewart. Wish Fast, a fundraiser for Make-A-Wish North Dakota, will take place on May 4th in Fargo, Bismarck, and Williston. We'll talk about that with organizer Nick Schulich. And horticulturist Ron Smith will join us to offer some helpful lawn and garden tips for spring. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.